Monster Man, Episode 380, Dragons Revisited, Part 2.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. Before we do that, though, some business to take care of. First, and most importantly, I want to thank a new Patreon backer. Yes, this is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they have pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's backer, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which has just completed its 100th episode and is all about the Deities and Demigods supplement and using religion and mythology in your fantasy role-playing games. So thank you very much, Amanda Norris Lunsford. It means a lot to me that you're enjoying the show enough to want to support it. In other news, I've got an event coming up in late September. So on the 25th of September, I, together with my co-author Gianluca Racagni, and I think our other co-author Dan Mersey is going to be there as well. We've got an event at the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds. It's about our new book, Lion Rampant, A Viking in the Sun, which is a supplement for the medieval miniatures war game Lion Rampant. And it's all about the career of Harald Hardrada, the king of Norway from the 11th century. Actually, before he became king of Norway, he had all kinds of adventures in the Mediterranean as part of the Varangian Guard, the famous Scandinavian and Rus unit in the Byzantine army. So if you're interested in medieval history and you can get to Leeds on the 25th, it's going to be a free event. There's going to be talks. There's going to be games. There's going to be other presentations, live demonstrations. It's going to be a lot of fun. So if you're in the area, I hope to see you there. I'll put a link to registration down in the show notes. So in today's episode, we are continuing our look at dragons, and today we're going to talk about the chromatic dragons in 2nd edition. Now, as you may recall, the chromatic dragons are the evil dragons, and there are 5 types. Those are black, blue, green, red, and white. And although they are all evil, they are all kind of evil in different ways. So the challenge this section faces is to create distinctive identities for 5 creatures that are fundamentally pretty similar. Let's see how it does it. A word before we start on the illustrations, they all appear to be by Mark Nelson, with colors by Les Dorscheid or Dorscheid. They are fine. They're not spectacular. They're very like, yep, that's a dragon, all right. Some of the artists, I mean, most notably Tony Terlizzi, seem to have kind of gone beyond the brief of the illustrations. Nelson seems to have hit it pretty exactly. As I've said, I'm not a huge fan of Nelson's art, but I can't really find anything specific to complain about. It's a bit matter of fact, I guess. I almost started a whole sidebar. What kind of art is illustrating a monster book? Is it a creative collaboration where the artist's contribution is expected to add to the narrative and the atmosphere, like a comic book where the ideal is a fusion of the creative efforts of the writer and artist? It's not just the artist illustrating a story that the writer is writing. Or is it more like illustrating a catalog where you have been given a specific thing that you have to draw a picture of, and the important thing is to draw as accurate a picture of it as possible? I think those differences in how artists approach the material kind of produce the differences in art in this book, maybe. Or maybe I'm overthinking it. All right, let's start by looking at the black dragon. Black dragons are cruel and cunning, but they're not super bright. They live in marshes, they spit acid, they have a lot of abilities that kind of increase the evil swampiness of the areas they live, so they kind of... there's an episode of the X-Files where Mulder's asking about, like, what's in the local area, and where the local cop says, we had a swamp before the EPA came along and made us call it a wetland. Or he says, we had a bog. You know, he uses some word that sounds sinister and menacing, and he says, you know, the EPA made us call it a wetland. And I feel like, you know, the black dragon moves into a wetland and turns it into an evil swamp, which is kind of a fun idea. That's something that's explored in more detail later on in, like, 5th edition, where that's actually mechanized. Maybe not for black dragons specifically, but just kind of for monsters in general. We get some description of their habitat and ecology, including the fact that they, like, their diet mainly consists of mollusks, which is boring, like fish and mollusks and, like, other swamp creatures. So they will sometimes eat larger animals, but they like to pickle them first, so they sort of, like, leave them to turn nasty in the stagnant pools around their swampy lairs, and then they come out and eat them once they're nice and rotted up. That's a very cool detail, and it also gives you a fun additional piece of description for the area around the dragon's lair. And it's very cool because you can have that bit where the party come across a tapir corpse festering in some horrible pond, and they all go, "Wait a minute, who would kill this animal but then just leave it here?" And the ranger's face turns pale and he goes, "Black dragon." That's kind of neat. Next, we got the blue dragon. Blue dragons are arrogant and proud. They live in deserts. They breathe lightning. A nice touch here is that they enjoy flying and do it for fun. They kind of like soar around. That's a neat thing. This may also be that they like to look down on their domains, because blue dragons like to live in flat areas because it makes it easier for them to like survey the area they control, but not just for like tactical defensive purposes, but simply because they like to admire how much they've conquered. And I think that that's a really fun image. You know, that there's going to be like one peak in this whole area, some mesa or whatever, and the blue dragon's going to live there so that it can gaze out over all the land it controls. Of course, I mean, it can also fly, so it'll do that as well. But I like that. You know, they're proud and haughty, so metaphorically, they like to spend their time above others. Sure. Next, you got green dragons. The green dragon has the award for the dragon in this episode that is most likely to also be the name of a pub. It is a woodland monster, and its particular form of, like, arrogant evil is that it tends to dominate and enslave others. They will turn, like, woodland creatures or other monsters into their troops, their servants. And then they're also described as being, quote, mean and, quote, rude. It's weird that this thing, like, creates an empire of tyranny in which harmless woodland creatures are made to serve its evil whims, and also it has really bad manners. They breathe poison gas, and we get the detail that they actually don't always kind of use their best attacks. They like to, if they're confident in winning a fight, they won't bother, like, bringing out their breath weapon, because they want their targets to suffer for longer, which is one of those motivations that is super annoying when given to a human villain so that a hero can conveniently get away, but makes sense with a creature that is sort of supernaturally evil, right? That it sometimes just, for reasons of evil principle, fails to kind of tactically exploit its abilities. Next up, you got red dragons. Red dragon is your classic dragon. It breathes fire. These ones are especially greedy and arrogant. And like green dragons, they don't always necessarily use their breath weapons, but here it's because they're a bit cautious about them. They're aware of how destructive their fiery breath is. And since they like to build up their hordes of gems and gold and what have you, they are cautious about using their fire because, like, they're there to rob you. They don't want to burn up all the valuable things that you might be carrying. So they only use it when they feel like they really need to. They live in mountains. One thing that's in a lot of these sections is something about their favorite food. So for example, the green dragon's favorite food is elves, and the red dragon's favorite food is, of course, maidens, because they are the classic dragon. And it says they sometimes use magic to kind of charm local communities into establishing that traditional kind of like maiden sacrifice setup that you get in, maybe not in a lot of dragon stories, but definitely in like dragon cartoons. Finally, we have the white dragon. Small, weak, and not very smart. And so their evil is characterized quite differently from the others. So they're said to be, quote, impulsive, vicious, and animalistic, close quotes. Which again, I like, you know, the haughty arrogance of the blue or the red dragons, the like sneaking malevolence of the black dragon, the tyranny of the green dragon, and then just the kind of like furious savagery of the white dragon. Red dragons, it says, particularly hate gold dragons, whom they regard as, quote, almost, close quotes, as powerful as they are. Like, the quotes are present in the text. So, yeah, white dragons. One of the things I like about the white dragons is here, again, actually, their tactics are defined as suboptimal in a way that I think kind of does make sense, which is that dragons can't just use their breath weapons all the time. They have to kind of wait for it to recharge. So the white dragon will often shoot its breath weapon off early, like it'll just use its most powerful attack early on, because it's just not really a strategic thinker. It wants to freeze stuff, and sometimes it'll just freeze the first thing it sees, and that's disadvantageous for it. And I think that that's a suboptimal tactic that's very realistic. Like, we all know, you know, intelligent human beings, not dumb white dragons, who, like, just want to shoot the proton cannon. And they don't care if it's, that's not how proton cannon works, but you know what I mean? Like, they live for the thrill of being able to go, proton cannon! And, you know, by gum, they're going to shoot it, right? They're going to shoot the frosty breath, even if it's not really necessary. And then something's going to come along where it is necessary, and they're not going to have it. Who doesn't want to shoot the proton cannon? It's fun. And they eat frozen food, haha. Literally, they like to freeze things and, like, store them in their lairs. So again, that's a very cool piece of imagery for the dragon's lair. So as you can see, there's a lot of little elements that I think are really enjoyable in these dragon descriptions. And on some previous monster entries, I have felt that a lot of these, like, ecological details aren't as useful. Here, I think, one, these are fantasy creatures and they're given, like, fantasy ecological details, as opposed to just being given kind of, like, whatever the writers could think of to fill in an ecology section. Like, here they have really put some thought into it, and they've put some thought into it from the perspective of a game. And that works particularly well, I think, for dragons, because individual dragons are probably going to take up a lot more of your time in a game than, like, individual Arakocras. So the proliferation of dragon lair detail makes sense because a dragon is a big deal. If you have a dragon's habitat, a dragon's cave, whatever, you're going to spend a lot more time in that region, so it's nice to have some build-up to it to help establish its atmosphere. Now, I still don't know that that necessarily merits 5 pages of this stuff. So I think there's a question of, does this merit its length? But the argument is much stronger than in some of the previous episodes, simply because, first, the information is more interesting and atmospheric, and second, there's more potential applications for that information because of the way in which dragons are part of the game. Okay, now, I mentioned my forthcoming book launch, and that's one of the reasons that my recording schedule has been kind of mixed up, and so we probably will not have a special episode in the middle of this week. But this Friday, you can look out for a special episode covering a surprise topic that I will not reveal till then. For once, not because I don't know what it is, but like I said, because it's a surprise. But I think you're going to enjoy it, so I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.